In this hour, Focus 580, we'll be talking about organizational change with a gentleman who is a pioneer in the field. His name is Richard Axelrod. He is currently working with Peter Block and the Association for Quality and Participation to develop the School for Managing, an innovative approach to management education. And we'll be talking specifically about a model of organizational change that he developed that he calls the engagement model, which he argues works much better than the way that we have been doing it for at least the last 20 years. We'll be talking about the subject this morning. And of course, as people who are listening have questions, if you'd like to call in, be a part of the conversation, you're welcome to do that. It's very easy. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and dial the number. Here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the local number, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and if it would be long-distance call for you, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And if you match the numbers with the letters on the phone, you get WILL. So 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Axelrod, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And and thanks for talking with us today.
Okay, thanks for having me.
I thought it might be interesting before we go on and talk about the engagement model, perhaps we might just talk a little bit about what we've done to date and look at some of the other ways that we have thought about change or organizations have approached change. Maybe even going back to the what is perhaps the most basic the kind of change that happens in organizations where you have strong, charismatic, maybe sometimes dictatorial leaders, and the change happens like this. The leader decides there will be change and then tells everybody, and I suppose if he has that kind of authority, then everyone goes along with it. That's perhaps the oldest way. There may, in fact, still be organizations, though, where that's the way they do it.
Yeah, well, I think that archetype is with us. It's very deep in our psyche. And the idea is that the leader, because of superior knowledge and insight and vision, sees the future, and then the leader's job is to convince the sort of reluctant multitudes to go along with them. So this is a very powerful and, I think, seductive model. And so that's what I call leader-driven change. And then if you think, you take that even to go back to King Arthur, you know, with his Knights of the Round Table. And that. And then there's, beginning in about the 1900s, there's what I would call process-driven change. And the idea was that if somehow we got control of the processes in the business, because about that time businesses were getting more complex, then that was the way to bring about change. And with that, you have the beginnings of industrial engineering, and then you could fast forward that to today to re-engineering and enterprise redesign. Then beginning in the 1980s, you began to hear about what we call team-driven change, and you had things like quality circles and employee involvement. And the idea here was that employees had knowledge, employees had voice, and that they could make a difference. And then in about the 1990s, you began to hear the term change management. And what you began to see was that in process-driven change, which was the industrial engineering approach and eventually gave rise to the big consulting firm, they began to look over and see what was going on with team-driven change and said, well, what if we could combine the best of both, the best of processes and people? And out of that came the idea of change management, which the idea was good, but it sort of lacked some things in its implementation.
Mm. Well, there, I think you summed it up very nicely that there were these sort of two, in terms of modern business and organization change, there were these two ideas. There was first the idea that if you were a manager, maybe the thing to do would be to go out there and get yourself some consultants, people who are really sharp. They would come in and tell you what to do, and then you would go to the organization and say, okay, this is what the consultant says. Mm-hmm. Then the idea that says, well, maybe it would make more sense if we really involve the people, involve the workforce. You know, they ought to be smart enough to have some pretty good ideas. So that's the team-driven approach. Then we came to the idea that says, you know, both of those ideas have their features. Let's put them together. So we had consultants and teams working together. But that seems to would seem to incorporate the best features of both of those models, and yet what you're arguing is that change management, for a variety of reasons, if it did work, it doesn't really work very well anymore. What's the problem that you see with that approach?
Well, a couple of things happen. One is as you move from leader-driven change to process-driven change, the role of the leader shifted, and the role of the leader became what I would call a cheerleader. Okay? They stepped aside and turned over the power to the consultant, and the change process essentially was driven by the consultant. And then another problem happened as you moved to team-driven change that, again, the leaders sort of abdicated and said, okay, all the knowledge is, quote, with the people in the organization, and I don't have to do anything. So you had this sort of abdication of leadership, which was one of the problems. The other thing that happened was that a structure became very popular called the parallel organization, which was the idea of setting up a structure, temporary structure, usually composed of a sponsor group, which was the role of the leadership, a steering committee, and then there were actually problem-solving groups. And in fact, that's the basic structure for organizational change today. Now, what happened was the idea was that this structure would be a place where people could step aside, learn about the organization, think about changes. And again, that was a great idea, but in fact what happened was people saw this as the few deciding for the many, so that you would have these groups, maybe 30, 40, even 100 people, meeting, deciding about the organization, how it was going to change, and people within the organization starting to worry about what they were going to do to us.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the major flaws, was the few deciding for the many.
And that's, I suppose, again, one of the big problems here if you're talking about trying to make some changes. And I know that you argue that your approach to change is as effective in a small organization as a big one. And I guess I'm thinking of relatively large organizations. If the management and small numbers of workers get together and they decide this is what we're going to do, then they present that to everybody else, then the big challenge is getting everybody else to go along, and they may have a variety of reasons for saying to themselves, if they don't say it out loud, well, this isn't going to work, either because they feel that it affects them adversely, or they think that it's not a good idea, or, you know, whatever it is. There's the big challenge. If you have a small number of people making the decisions, everybody else has got to carry them out. You got to have them with you, and if they're not, the change just isn't going to go.
Yeah. And what we would see is rarely was the strategy or the idea for change so flawed that it couldn't be implemented. But where the processes would always run into trouble would be, could they get the sufficient ownership and buy-in? And sort of the flaw in the thinking was that even when you put these groups together and saying that they would represent people, represent different points of view, people out in the organization never really felt that their voice was being heard. And so that became a problem when it came to buy-in.
It seems that one big problem here with at least with a couple of these strategies is, and maybe again it's going to be an overriding problem for managers, for them to feel that they're striking the right balance between managing and letting people sort of have the freedom to do what they know and you hope that based upon their daily experience working in an intimate way with whatever it is you do, that they're going to have some good ideas about how things get done. Managers, though, I'm sure that they think, well, I'm a manager, so I'm supposed to be managing.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's easy to say to them, you need to give your workers the freedom to do their jobs. But at the same time, managers, I'm sure they have to feel that they're doing, that they're fulfilling their role, and perhaps they also want to feel that they're in control.
Right.
So I'm sure that must be a difficult thing when you talk to people in management.
Yeah, and I think what we're not advocating is that managers let go completely. In fact, what we're saying is that managers and leaders at all levels have information, and that information is necessary to get good solutions. So just as having the leader be the only one who decides what should be done, if you delegate completely or what I would call in some senses abdicate, then you're missing system knowledge. And so what we're advocating is bringing people together at all levels to address the issues, okay, and also bringing in outside stakeholders such as customers and suppliers.
This, the change management, did it ever work? Did it once work well?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think if you think back historically, each of these was a step forward, and it fit the times. And so and I think one of the reasons it worked because it was an advancement over what was, okay? And so what we're seeing in organizations, particularly ones who've been involved in trying to bring about organizational change over long periods of time, is that they get more and more sophisticated. So then they need different kinds of approaches because what might have worked 10, 15 years ago does not necessarily work today. You could see some of the work at Ford and the quality is job one and some of those kinds of things as examples of this process actually working.
Mm-hmm. What sort of a factor does the need to be able to make changes quickly, is that one of the things that has made some of these other ways of changing problematic, the fact that they just don't respond quickly enough?
Yeah. In fact, that's in some sense how we came to this approach, that we would go in and, having done change management consulting, we would go in to a client and we'd say, well, we want to work with this small group of people and we'll work with them for 6 or 9 months. And then at the end of that, we will bring the solution out to the organization. And people are saying their business would change so much in that 9 months that it just couldn't work for them, that they needed ways to bring about change more quickly.
And the engagement model that does that?
Yeah, I think what happens is that if you take what we've been discussing, there's a period where you design the change and you think about that and in a traditional method, then you go out and you solicit buy-in. And what we see is that whole time of getting acceptance, because we've involved so many people in the beginning, gets reduced, so that when you figure out what you're going to do, the amount of time it takes to get the organization to go along with it and implement it is reduced, I'd say, maybe half, maybe three-quarters, because people know what's going on from the very beginning.
I should introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580. His name is Richard Axelrod. He's an expert in the area of organizational change, and he is the author of the book Terms of Engagement, Changing the Way We Change Organizations. So if you're interested in reading some more about his idea, the engagement model of organizational change, the book is published by Barrett Kohler Publishers out of San Francisco, and the book should be available if you would like to take a look at it. And, of course, also questions are welcome. If you'd like to call in here, talk with our guest, you can do that too. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, any place that you might be listening. The toll-free line, 800-222-9455. So, again, locally here, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how it is you came to develop this idea, because I think that you were doing something that was kind of similar to this,
mm-hmm.
and that this is made perhaps a further refinement you developed.
Yeah. In the early 1990s, we developed a process called the conference model. And the idea of the conference model was to bring large groups of people together to redesign an organization or a process. And we would, we could bring anywhere from 80 to several hundred people together in one room. They would be people at all levels, and including outside people such as customers, suppliers, other important stakeholders. And we would create organizational vision, we would look at processes, and we would create an organizational redesign. And, so we were able to cut the time to implement change, create and implement change, in half and reduce the subsequent resistance that we talked about earlier. And so we've been using this process for, about the last 10 years. And we began to look at it and try to understand why it worked. And also there were some other processes that were similar to ours. We say, what's going on here? Why are people getting excited? Why are they willing to come in at night and off shift and work on things like that? Why is it that we're seeming to be able to get the kind of implementation that's required to bring about change? And, you know, every time we would go into an organization, we would always customize this process. So we began to try and look and say, what were the key or fundamental principles that were going on here? And then we looked at that and compared it to other processes that we knew. We came up with four principles. And the first one was what we called widening the circle of involvement, which means involving more people than you ever thought prudent or possible, and including people that you don't necessarily often think of, including people who might you might think who are out there who would resist or oppose to what you're doing. Then the second principle was what we call connecting people to each other and to ideas, because you can have a crowd, but then, you know, you can have a crowd of people who listen to a speech, too. So we have to find some ways to connect people to each other and to the ideas of the process. Then the third principle was creating communities for action, because you can have a group of people and they can connect to each other, but unless they're willing to, you know, take action, it's meaningless. And then the fourth principle was what we called embracing democratic principles, which means providing freedom and autonomy, means listening, providing information, including people in decision-making. So it's those sorts of things. And also a sense of bringing equity and fairness to the process. And what we see these is a system of principles. And a lot of the stories in the book are of people who just said, okay, we've got a change process, we've got a problem, and how can we apply these four principles to what we're doing? So that really, when you think about the engagement paradigm, it's the application of those four principles.
We have a caller to talk with, and others certainly, if you have questions you'd like to call in, talk with our guest, Richard Axelrod, you're welcome to do that. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Urbana on our line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
So you call the process the engagement process. What happens when a company downsizes? I would think that your process probably wouldn't work if people felt that they were going to be losing their jobs. Or do you not work with downsizing?
We have, and it's sort of counterintuitive, but if, let me go back to the sense of democratic principles. When we worked with downsizing, what we say to the organization, and this is where the principle of equity and fairness comes in, we say, all right,
barely hear you.
I'm sorry. I'm saying that this is where the principle of equity and fairness comes in. Can you hear me now okay?
Yeah.
And
I think I'm going to hang up and listen. Okay.
Yeah, sure. Thanks.
You.
Go ahead, Mr. Axelrod.
All right. This is where the principle of equity and fairness comes in, and it's part of the democratic principle. So if we're going to work with a company that's downsizing, we're saying, all right, let's look at this process. And is it the process going to be equitable and fair? How are people going to be treated who are downsized? What's the process for that? Is all that laid out in advance? And we find that when companies are able to do that, when we had such a situation at British Airways where they really laid out in advance how they would treat people, what would happen to them, that people were willing to participate. You wouldn't think so, but they are. But I think the key to that is the sense of what's going on has a sense of equity and fairness, and that I'm going to be treated okay in the process. And as some people said, I would rather have a say in it than have it being done to me.
Well, that's interesting. Does that mean that the employees had some sort of role in deciding who was going to keep their jobs?
Well, not on an individual basis, okay?
Uh-huh.
But they would have a say in how the work was being redesigned. Because the who would actually stay is actually a management decision. But the actual redesign of the work was done by employees, some of whom, when they looked at the new organization, voluntarily said, well, I think I'd like to work at some other part of the organization, or maybe it's time for me to do something different. and others didn't have that choice. But what they all knew at the very beginning is how they would be treated. I think another thing that often goes on with these things is that the top remains unchanged, where it's the bottom that's downsized.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what you have to have is a process that encompasses the whole organization, not just, you know, so that everybody is part of this process of the downsizing, not it being done to just one group of people.
Going back to, you were talking about the fact that the model that you develop has basically these four sorts of features, and one of them is that essentially you want to, for change to be more effective, you need to involve more people in the process.
Mm-hmm.
I can imagine that there is a point at which it becomes awkward if too many people are involved. And I guess I'm just wondering, you know, you also talk in the book about the fact, about the idea of critical mass, that there is a certain number of people who have to get involved. Is there a line past which you get too many people involved, and that if you give everybody a voice, that what happens is you just can find yourself in endless debates about what we do, and that becomes counterproductive?
Yeah. What we look at is, and it depends on the organization, we would say a minimum of 20%, and we've had other organizations where they've said 40%, and in some smaller organizations, and I'm talking maybe organizations of about 1,000, they said we want to get everybody involved. So we usually leave it up to the, you know, we kind of give the organizations these guidelines, and then the organization makes a decision about, you know, where they want to go. What we have are two ways of involving people. We have these what we call large group meetings, which are the conferences, and that's where we bring the hundreds of people together. And then we have another process that we call walkthroughs, where the decisions that are made in the conferences get taken out into the organization, and people meet in smaller groups of maybe 20 to 30, and oftentimes these meetings are voluntary, and they give their input, and that goes back into the conference. So you have this process of taking information out into the organization and then going back into getting that input and having it fit back into the change process. In one organization that we worked with in California, their goal was to involve 40% of the people in the organization in either a conference or a walkthrough. And what happened was when they did an employee survey and they asked people, did you feel like you had a voice in the organizational change? 85% of the people said yes, which was, an astounding number.
And is it that common that then when you, for example, you do the walkthroughs, then if people on that level look at proposals that have been made and they say, well, look, from my experience here doing the job on this level, I think this is really not the right approach. Let me tell you why, and let me suggest something else. Then does that information really end up then feeding back and changing the plan? Can that really end up changing the direction of the change?
Yeah, I think what happens is in the conferences we have a broad based representation of the organization, and what I see more in practice, I think what you're saying theoretically is possible to happen.
Mm-hmm.
What happens mostly in practice is we see more fine tuning of the approach. What, you know, you're basically in the right area, but you forgot this little piece here, or you forgot this idea here. So I see it more as people, we've never seen one that was so wrong that people said, well, you have to throw it out completely. But we do see them as fine-tuning it based on their experience.
I expect also that part of the functions of the conferences, when you get the large groups together, is that it does do another one of the things that you talk about in this model, and that is it brings together people from different parts of the organization that perhaps ordinarily might not have any contact with each other.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing how many times people come together who've maybe talked on the phone in a large organization but never met. In one organization, this was a paper mill that we worked with, it was very siloed, so people worked in their, you know, different part of the manufacturing process, and they came together in this large conference, and they start talking about issues or problems, and people say, "Oh, I didn't know we caused you that problem. We can fix that right away." I mean, so just this building of personal connections to people creates links that otherwise aren't there, not only across the organization but also vertically.
I think that's a really interesting notion that you would have to create a framework for that to happen. But perhaps that's just the nature of large organizations, that there would be, otherwise there would be no way for the people, say, who were making some sort of policy or making some sort of decision on one level that was affecting the way that somebody else had to work or do their job, and it was a big problem. And the people on the other end, they would complain about, yeah, those other guys, they don't know what they're doing, and this and that and the other thing. But somehow the word would never get back to the other party that they were creating a problem for. You know, for people, that people A in group A were creating a problem for people in group B.
Yeah, and what we see often, and what we try to do in the in a lot of these conferences, is to say, you know, we are both the creator and receiver of problems. You know, there's problems we create in our work unit that impact other people, and then there's other problems that are created in other work units that impact us. And when people begin to see that they're both the creator and receiver of those kinds of things, a lot of the blaming stops, and they began to look at these things as issues that need to be resolved.
I would guess, too, that perhaps this process might actually legitimate, I don't know what you mean, the right word, complaints that might be drifting around informally. You know, maybe the people in group A, yeah, the word gets back to them that the people in group B are really unhappy with something that they've done. Mm-hmm. But they might tend to dismiss that. And perhaps if you have this kind of more structured way to get these people together with some facilitation, that maybe then the folks in group A would be much more inclined to take seriously what the folks in group B are saying.
Yeah, and what you see often in organizations is you see this, what we would call this intergroup phenomena, where, you know, the people in A basically say, if B was only as smart as we were, if they understood the world like we did, then everything would be all right. But guess what? The people in group B are saying the same thing.
Yeah.
And so you put them in the room together, and they face the common issue, and they say, oh, my God, these are human beings. You know, they're not the hated other. And so a lot of barriers come down just by bringing people together.
I assume that also one of the things that happens here that maybe does not ordinarily happen is not only are you bringing people together from different parts of the organization that might not have that much contact, but I suppose if this works right, you're bringing your top management together with workers, and there again, it's almost a class kind of a line that that probably doesn't get crossed very much,
right?
And that here another group, you know, two groups of people that ought to have some contact that probably don't.
And what we'll do with we often do the seating so that we have people sitting at tables at mixed levels and mixed departments. And so maybe in a smaller, you know, even though we might have hundreds of people there, in a smaller group of 8 to 10, they get to know people as human beings, and that begins to facilitate the conversation. The other thing that happens is when we bring in outsiders such as customers, suppliers, sometimes interested people from the community, that voice also gets heard in a different way. So often, like it's one thing we see very often is it's one thing for leaders to say our customers want this or they require this or they have these kinds of complaints about our products, but then when we actually bring them into a session and people in the organization hear that information firsthand, it's just not management trying to get us to do something else. They actually hear it from the customer, and it has a very different kind of message that way.
Mm. We have another caller here, someone on a car phone to talk with. We'll do that. They're on our line number 4.
Good morning.
Yes.
From what I'm hearing, a lot of what you're talking about is increasing personal communications, involving people and getting people to actually talk to each other. And traditionally, you know, whatever the style was, change got handled because one person told another person or told a group of people. Then we got into telephone communication, and now the big thing is to send 8 million emails a day to everybody. And with email, you know, with telephone, you lose the face-to-face visual part of the communication. And now with email, you lose what you could pick up over the phone with over vocal communication. So how do you combat, you know, the increasing impersonalization of communication once you put this process in order and you know, into place? And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Okay. Well, that's an interesting question. What do you think?
Well, I think what we're doing, I mean, I think in a sense the process may be an antidote to this, because we're actually bringing people together and trying to create the links, and oftentimes we'll do, you know, maybe two or three of these conferences. So we're trying to build strong personal links between people, okay? And then you can use the email and as a support or follow-up to what's going on. But everything that we've read on both the use of electronic media and knowledge management and talking with other people in the field says that the most important thing is the personal communication, and that you can use the databases and electronic communications as a secondary support. But when you turn it around, you don't get those sorts of things.
What do you do to try to institutionalize these channels of communication so that after you as consultant pack up and your workshops are over and you go away, that this doesn't just become a one-time thing?
Right. Okay. Well, I think one of the key things is having the organization have a deep understanding of these principles, because what our belief is about the principles, it's sort of like if you remember in math, you know, if you would memorize a formula, okay, and then comes the math test and the instructor gives you a different problem, you don't know what to do. But if you understand the principles deeply, then if you get something new, then you're able to address that situation in the future. So one of the things we see happening is that as organizations work with this process and people throughout the organizations begin to understand the principles, then the capacity of the organization begins to shift in terms of their ability to manage and handle change. And I think that's the lasting benefit, because, you know, we can bring people together and we make an organizational change, but, you know, things happen in the environment and things change. So that change may not be the right thing to do 2 or 3 years from now. And the issue is then, what do you do 2 or 3 years from now to respond? And what we see is that as people learn to work in this format, they take that back into the organization. And as they learn to understand the principles, then they begin to apply those, not always in this large scale, but even into daily work or individual meetings that they may be having.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it might be interesting to have you give a specific example, sort of a case study, because we've been talking here rather in the abstract, maybe of a company that you worked with and how this worked for them.
Okay. Well, one example from Detroit Edison, where they had been going at trying to change their supply chain process for a number of years and really didn't have much to show for it. And so they've been doing it in a fairly traditional method. They asked us to come in, and we began to work with these principles and began to think about how we could bring about change in the organization. And the first thing we realized was a lot of good content work had been done, so we didn't want to throw that out. And we started, in a sense, we started with a series of walkthroughs where people from Detroit Edison went out into the organization, talked about the supply chain process, talked about the idea that we were going to involve about 250 people to look at the work that had been done, what needed to be changed, and how to make the supply chain process more efficient within Detroit Edison. So we started with a walkthrough. We had one conference, and, you know, again, like we said, we wanted to have 250 people there. We only had about 180 show up at the first one. Went out, did a walkthrough, came back, ready for the second conference. We had over 500 volunteers. And we think what happened between the first and the second conference was a lot of the initial skepticism and cynicism got reduced because people began to realize that they could have a voice. What happened at the end of it was that Detroit Edison identified 26 processes that they could, projects that they could use this new supply chain improvement process in, that ended up saving the company millions of dollars. So, and this all happened within the space of about 6 months, from the time that we first met with them to the time that these projects began to be initiated. So that's sort of one concrete example. Another one is a company we're working with right now, a large manufacturing firm, and we've just been working with the principals. And we started out, we worked with the leadership, and we worked, essentially it was like 14 people, and that expanded out to 50. And now it's expanded out to about, I think, about 300 people at various levels. It's in process now. But I think what's interesting about it is that what the leadership is constantly doing is saying, all right, let's look at these principles. Let's look at how we apply them. So at one point when we had the top 50 leaders of this engineering organization, they said, well, we need to widen this circle. So they came up with, I thought, sort of a unique way. They randomly assigned each of the leaders a different pay grade, and it was their job to bring someone from that pay grade to the next meeting. And so that group then expanded from 50 to, I think, about 150.
We have another caller here. Let's talk with them, someone in Champaign. It's line number one. Hello.
Good morning, Ivan.
It would help us if you could speak up, sir. You're kind of faint.
All right.
Thanks.
An old phone here on this particular one. I wanted to say thanks for the show. I've enjoyed the show. And I particularly wanted to thank the person who called in with the message about how email might actually be, these are my words, not his, a step down from the level of communication, in so much as the emotional aspect was disconnected. Of course, this is lessened if you're emailing persons that you know a great deal. You can extrapolate all the feelings, presumably. But it was a wonderful idea in so much as it was a totally brand new thought for me, which has been a long time since I've had one of those, and I really appreciated it. In defense of email, I'd like to say that it does give you written text wherein you can refer back to it and make sure that you got the right idea, etc., but that might take additional emailings. But if your guest finds any of this appropriate, I'd be happy to listen, and I can either stay on or hang up, whichever you wish.
Well, do you want it, Mr. Axelrod? You have further thoughts about email?
Yeah, well, I think we're still trying to figure out how to make this tool work. I mean, I think it does, you know, in terms of what the caller said, you know, I often find myself going back to emails, and it's great for short little jots. I found it, difficult. I often caught myself when you're discussing controversial things over email, just stopping and saying, I got to talk to this person, because I could see where the emails were going, and they weren't, you know, it was, the conversation was going to be, you know, disastrous, because you just don't have that give and take that you have with someone in person. And then I've often thought, I wonder what people were saying when the telephone first came out, and were they saying, you know, we've lost the ability to get, all the nonverbal cues we get when we talk with someone in person. And so I think we're still learning how to work with this.
Well, I think those are very worthy ideas. Of course, when telephone first came out, it obviously was seized upon as a great distance breaker, and it probably was thought of as a great extension of our abilities. And the detrimental aspect, which you've clearly described there, wasn't factored in. I think they just didn't care. Like, once upon a time in this country, vaccinations didn't receive the kind of press they receive now, because everybody understood that, okay, you might lose 1% of your population, but you're going to save 99%, and it's so much better than smallpox and other things, et cetera. And I've just picked smallpox out of the air. I'm not trying to be 100% accurate about that, but the point I'm making is the belief systems, the understanding of needs, the understanding of what the outcomes could be, are so much different now as people people take so much for granted.
Yes, yes.
I have a question that you've given me listening to you. Let's see if I can formulate it quickly here. Do you find in business that the emailings are too brief and cryptic, or do you find that they're too long and poorly have poor English compositions so that nobody knows what they're really trying to say together? Do you have any observations in those areas?
Well, I mean, I can just go by my own experience. Where I really like emails are sort of the short ones that, you know, are we going to meet on this date? And, you know, where you're just sort of passing, you know, traffic that you can just do in a few sentences. And those really work. I think the longer ones in general don't work. But an example from our own consulting practice is we have some alliances with consulting firms in the UK and across the country here. And what we found is, you know, if we periodically we get together first and we have a meeting and we sort of figure out our direction and what we're going to do on a project, then we can do an awful lot on email between times, which saves us the getting together. But we periodically have to come together face-to-face to keep those personal connections and get the overall of what it is we're trying to do.
I want to appreciate the comments of the caller. We're getting down to our last maybe 2-3 minutes. We have someone else I'd like to include. Here is the caller in Chicago, our line number 4. Hello.
Thank you. I was wondering if your guest had ever given or applied his thoughts on organizational change to the big organization, that is the World Trade Organization, that people are talking about. And the matter of engagement and personal contact and insight and illumination of what's going on, it seems to be a factor that's excluded, at least from the public's point of view, as to what is really occurring. Have you given some thoughts about that and about the fairness or lack of it as to what is perceived to be going on? And I was just wondering what you had thoughts on.
Well, I had some thoughts last year in Seattle.
Yeah.
That maybe some of these processes might help, but they didn't call me, so, you know.
Well, the necessity seems to be apparent to get more engagement and public awareness because, then you have the matter of the mega mergers that are occurring and the organizational change that is, the recent one with Daimler-Benz and the Chrysler, and suddenly there's big shakeouts, and so things are happening where organizational change are having impact, not only that way, as well as automation and computerization and robots, etc. So your application along organizational change has a lot to aspire to.
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think the thing that happens with mergers is they're not really mergers. There's very few mergers or creating of new entities. There's a lot of takeovers. There's a lot of winners and losers.
Okay. Yeah, I remember a program where Dr. Kissinger and William Buckley were speaking together about the things at the turn of the millennium and addressing some of the matters of changes that are occurring, and they said, we haven't even developed the institutions to begin to deal with these changes.
Mm-hmm.
So organizational factors, who knows? Well, I'd like to see you apply your thoughts to some of these matters. Bye-bye.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Perhaps related to that, as a way of kind of rounding things out as we finish up, one of the points that characterizes the model that we've been talking about is the idea of embracing democracy, your words. And I think that for some people, they might say, people that might, we might say we're cynics, or they might say they were realists, that it's very, very difficult for large corporations, large business entities, to indeed be democratic organizations. It just runs counter to the kind of values that come with being a large profit-driven entity. Is it really possible for these organizations to be democratic by their nature, or is there some limit to that, some line past which you really can't go?
Yeah, well, I think what I was doing in saying embracing democracy is I think there's a trend towards being more democratic. And I think, you know, particularly when you look at the Internet, I mean, the moment an organization puts email in its system,
mm-hmm.
they have no control about how people will use it. so that there's a way in which people could communicate where they could never communicate before. But in terms of what I'm talking about a set of democratic principles about equity and fairness. So is your business and what you're doing in your organization, does it have a sense of equity and fairness? Are you sharing information to the max? Okay. Are you providing, involving people in as much as you can in the decision-making process? And when you do, are you giving people a sense of freedom and autonomy so that they can take action? That's what I mean by democracy, because a lot of times people will say, well, democracy means everybody has to vote, and I would submit that voting is not necessarily a symbol of democracy, because there's plenty of countries where people vote and they're not democratic at all. They're told who to vote for, or there's one vote on the party. So I think it's more than just it's voting. It's having a sense that your voice counts, and it's about these four things that I mentioned before: the equity and fairness, the information sharing, the decision making, and having a sense of freedom and autonomy.
Has it ever been the case, with your experience, that an organization might look at this kind of model, might implement it because they think that it will simply make the organization run more smoothly and hence be more profitable, and that as a result of that, changes come about in the organization that no one would have anticipated? Maybe even some people, if they were honest, would say, I'm not sure that I think that was such a good thing. That wasn't what we had in mind. But because you instituted these other things, built these channels of communication, you encouraged people to speak up, to talk about the things that they thought could be done to make things run better, that then things happen that no one would have predicted.
Well, I think you may have unintentionally touched on the thing that happens that no one predicted or predicts, is that it is this opening up channels of communication, creating links. When people talk about the process, they say, well, we created this change, and, well, that was good, but guess what? We got these other benefits. Okay? We got deeper connections between our departments. We got people who understand change better. They understand our business better. They understand how to handle change in their own part of the organization. And it's that increased capacity, which I think is the biggest unintended consequence, that people talk about, I think, far after the specific change that they've actually implemented.
No one comes along afterwards and said, you know, maybe we shouldn't have done this in the first place?
No, I don't think we've had anybody who said we shouldn't have done it in the first place. They might say, we could have done it better, okay, or with hindsight, we might have done this or we might have done that. But I can't think in 10 years of doing this where they've said, no, this was a big mistake to bring people together to do this.
Yeah.
I think a caution would be that if you were doing it, I mean, you can't do this from a purely mechanistic standpoint. So you have to have the business reason for doing it. Okay? So it might be we want things to run smoothly, and we want to be more efficient. We want to work with our customers better. But it's the way you go about doing it that's important, is as important as what you do. And that's where all these principles come in mind.
Well, we are going to have to leave it at that, I'm afraid, because we're here at the end of the time. We want to say, Mr. Axelrod, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Okay, thank you. Enjoyed being with you.
Our guest, Richard Axelrod, and if you would like to read more about this, you can look for the book that he's written that lays out the strategy for change, Terms of Engagement, Changing the Way We Change Organizations. That's the title. And the subtitle, Barrett Kohler Publishers out of San Francisco, they publish the book.